FM. I actually don't think this is going to be radio. I think we're going to just throw it up on the podcast feed, but so we can curse at least, right? Unless we could do it either way. But anyway, unless you particularly want to be on the radio, Wes.
Either way, it's fine with me. I just need to know if I should curse or not curse. I'll try to not curse. I don't know. Whatever you want.
Also good information for me.
So anyway... So anyway, we're going to just, so we got Wes, who is a friend of ours, Wes Cheek from, he's from Florida originally, right?
I'm from Destin.
You're from, so funny story about Destin.
Yeah. I got a lot of funny stories about Destin, but go ahead.
That's a funny place. But after the storm, like Hurricane Katrina, that's where we evacuated to. And I lived in Destin for like 6 months and Scott lived there for about 3 months. It was a really interesting fucking town.
Where did you live?
I lived at the Pelican Beach.
I went to Fort Walton Beach High my senior year.
Yeah, we were in Flutie Town. I mean, not Flutie, Werfel Town. It was a lot of
that's,
big.
That's where I graduated from.
No shit. So Scott went there for like a half a year.
Really? I was a freshman when Werfel was a senior.
Okay. Nice. Yeah.
So I actually was. I had a little Werfel crossover in there.
So did Werfel like pants you ever?
He never pants. He's actually like a super decent guy.
Yeah, he seems like that.
Weird. He's just a super decent guy, and he still is around. Like my mom used to work at the Destin Library, and he would come in. He's just like he's a normal guy, and you know he does lots of like charity work. And
yeah, I knew that. He's like a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure he wasn't a perfect dude. He was a football player, but
yeah,
as football players go, he was a nice guy.
He was
worse
Christian.
In high school.
He's a Christian, but he's not one of those Christians.
Yeah, I did get to see him play like every game in high school. He's amazing.
He
was the kicker. He kicked too. He kicked like he used to run for touchdowns. Like, high school football is so different. Like Danny Werfel used to run for touchdowns a lot.
That's wild. Well, anyway, Wes is so where are you working at? You're at a university out there or?
Yeah, I'm at Ritz Meikan University in Kyoto, Japan at the Disaster Mitigation of Urban Cultural Heritage Institute.
Yeah, I wonder why
we're the title.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's a lofty title.
I never remember what the name of the place that I work is, even though I'm here every day, because there's the Japanese title for it, the English title, and then it gets worded differently on lots of stuff, so I always get a little confused.
Yeah, but anyway, so we wanted to talk to Wes about, I guess, first off, it's always great to catch up with you, man, in general.
Good to see you.
But also I want to talk a little bit about this sort of coronavirus crisis that is sort of sweeping not just the United States, but most of the world right now. And I've been kind of locked down in my house for almost everything since last Friday when they closed down all the schools in Louisiana. Now we have videos of Coach O from LSU, saying, actually, you got to follow the game plan, guys. And you got to make sure you cough in your sleeve and, wash your hands for 30 seconds and all these other things.
Yeah, which is always like the funny thing. Cause the governor's address came up and I was like, oh yeah, there's the governor. There's some other guy, probably like the lieutenant governor. I was like, is that Coach O in the back?
I haven't watched that yet, but if I did want to get advice from somebody, it probably would be Coach O. Like, why not?
I love that guy. He's cool. Yeah. Like, Coach O seems all right.
Yeah
he's got that cool voice that they say is like just gonna make him lose it. He's gonna be mute one day, they say.
I loved him in the water.
I don't know how it's possible anyway, but I would never tell a Cajun that he can't do something.
Yeah, 100%. I know better just because that's my uncle or whatever.
Right.
So anyway, we want to kind of catch up on sort of the scope and the scale of what this coronavirus thing could possibly, actually be. Not to alarm anybody for sure, but it's kind of simultaneously better and worse than we're thinking about it, I guess. Right? Does that make sense? Well, or is it just worse across the board?
It's I keep telling everyone it's really bad. So I've been saying for a few weeks now, it's really bad. And I don't want to, it's always hard to tell people like you should be scared. I don't think being scared is that helpful, correct. But you should be as concerned and attentive and worried as you could possibly be about something.
Right. So like listen to the CDC and all this other stuff and like do no. The,
yeah, don't mess around with it. No, not don't listen to CDC. Yes, listen. Do whatever you can to like stay out of the path mm-hmm. of this, because one, you don't want it. If you've read, I don't know if you've read the accounts of like what it's like to have this. Mm-hmm. It's bad. It's really bad.
Right.
Two, if you know any doctors or healthcare professionals and know what they're up against right now, like don't create an extra workload for them because they're way over their capacity right now.
Yeah. We were talking, Scott and I both were on a Zoom call with a friend last night who she used to work at SEIU Local 21 as an organizer. Now she's up in St. Paul. But she was talking about the sort of situation with there being such a shortage of PPE, protection gear, personal protection gear for, you know, like breathing. So you don't, you know, catch. Correct. I mean, again, I'm a dummy when it comes to speaking about this stuff, but essentially the hospital that the hospitals that are up there are essentially saying we're out of it. We're not going to pay for it. We're not going to buy it, but we still want your workers to go in. And that's an actually scary thing, but it's hard to really say like you shouldn't go in there, but like, why aren't we getting this gear and all this other stuff?
Sure.
It's like a huge economic problem.
Yeah. I won't name the hospital just so not get people in trouble, but I've been communicating with people in New Orleans during the last week who are doctors there. And it's the same thing, right? It's like they've been having to like wash down their PPEs in between patients. Like they have like one for themselves, and they're out of masks. They've been out of masks, and they're pooling their own money to buy masks. But like, there's no real communication with the government. They're trying to like independently buy them. I know some people, and this will tell you the kind of this relates to the larger conditions of America that are defaulting on their student loans, their gigantic medical student loans, so that they can get money to pay for masks to go into work. You know, so it's that type of situation right now. It's out of control.
Yeah, that's and this we were talking. We had a friend of the show, Ben Yudishin, on earlier, who's he's a nanny. Like he does childcare for a living.
Right.
But he also has his own sort of like, you know, he's a kind of a somewhat, you know, quasi public commentator. And we were talking a little bit about how, like, when you see a catastrophe like the coronavirus that's happening, you know, COVID-19, I mean, I guess there's all kinds of coronaviruses, right? But
that's kind of what we're calling. I mean, in Japan, that's the only thing that it's called. So if you want to go with it, it's fine.
Whatever. But I guess my point is that, like, when you have one of these sort of like disasters that go throughout the world, it sort of lays bare what are actually essential workers and what are essential jobs and what are the sort of bullshit jobs that, you know, you can basically go home and I mean, I'm saying this for myself, and I think that my job is socially essential. I'm a teacher. My brother is a, you know, makes pizza for a living, and he does a couple of other things. But I mean, like, the people that do more like the lower paying, harder working, the only people in my school right now, pretty much, you know, that aren't administration, that are at school, are like custodial staff, right? Or cafeteria staff, because the kids got to eat and the buildings need to be cleaned down. So the people that get the shortest end of the fucking stick in this society are the ones that are asked to answer the bell for these catastrophes.
Yeah. So I used to teach this sociology class at Tulane, and I get all the freshmen, right? And so one of the things that's kind of hard to convince the freshmen is when I tell them, like, you realize our entire economy is just kind of made up, right? It exists in our minds, and that's the only place it exists. And so I asked them kind of the question, which seems, I think, an easy question to us, but it's hard for freshmen at Tulane, which is like, if your garbage man decided to not come into work for a week, and like the nearest hedge fund manager to you decided not to come into work for a week, which one actually changes your life?
Which one would matter?
Right? Which one matters to you? And like, you actually get, you know, you get kids like, huh, I've never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, this is a crash course in people having to think about it that way. Right?
I mean, because, like, sorry, Charles Schwab didn't go to work today, but like, that didn't really change my life.
Right. And I mean, I suppose the capitalist argument would be like, well, in the long run, but it's like, well, you know. Since when has capitalism
or any capitalist ever cared about the long run? They always care about the next fucking quarter, the next fucking day trading, and the next, like, most immediate thing, right?
That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah, and it's built on short-term thinking, and you see that. And it's kind of weird being a disaster researcher now is that, like, I would say, I don't want to speak for everyone, but most everyone I talk to in that writes about disasters before this, and especially now after it, have just said over and over again, like, capitalism isn't equipped to do these things. It's just not, because it can't stop. It can't pause. It can't ever pause. And it can't ever consider things that require really long-term planning and require things that there's no profit motive in at all.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard somebody say that FDR, like, he set up a system that could, like, probably stop the Great Depression from ever happening. But, like, the past, like, 60 years, they've been trying to dismantle it slowly. Yeah. Like,
undo the New Deal, undo the Great Society, undo these social programs that benefit working class people, because the ideology of capitalism is to essentially, I mean, it's a cliche at this point, especially on the left, but, like, to say, you know, capitalism, the whole point of it is to strip the copper wires out of the society and make it so that people are getting as little as possible. And you're sort of like squeezing that lemon or that orange or whatever and getting as much out of that as you possibly can, even when it seems like it's used.
Right. And, you know, the other side of that is the ideology part of it is to then convince people, well, the reason this isn't functioning now is because the idea of government or the idea of anything of society, right?
Yeah, we don't live in society. Reason.
Right. That's the reason this stuff doesn't work, is because it can't work.
It's right. Like,
well, you know, you can continue that lie for a while. And there are people who are going to believe it after this is over. You know, there's just people like that. But I mean, look around. Right.
Yeah. But all of history just spits in the face of that, right? All of history basically means that human cooperation is necessary, but when you get to certain points, I suppose, like, people want to make themselves exceptions to that. Like, people want to say that they're, like, if, we were talking about this also, but, like, in the 1800s, you know, Rockefeller and fucking Carnegie and all these, you know, robber baron types, they were sort of considered to be the only people that could kind of inject the magic that gets the returns that makes that engine go, right? Which is bullshit. I mean, they just bought up, I mean, like, Rockefeller in specific, he bought up refining, he bought up transport, he bought up every part of the oil industry so that he could just run it like it's his own fucking cartel.
Right. You know, I was thinking this week about the Johnstown flood, which happened, what year, like late 1800s, right? Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about that disaster, it's it happened because this fishing club, the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, it was like a, it was for, like, rich people from cities in around Pittsburgh, like all the steel magnates and stuff could come out to the country and be at their hunting and fishing club. And there used to be this kind of functional dam there, but they redesigned it so it would be the kind of appealing to people to sail around on this lake and fish.
Yeah.
And that's the dam that gave way and flooded Johnstown and killed over 2,000 people, right?
Tourism and killed them people.
Yeah. So the people in the town sued the hunting and fishing club, saying it was their fault. And members of the club were like Andrew Carnegie and guys like that, right? They didn't win the lawsuit, but then guys like Andrew Carnegie were like, oh, we feel bad about what happened to your town, so we'll pay, like, for some buildings to help rebuild it, right? And so that's kind of what you get out of these, right?
And they're not doing it for nothing. They're doing it to write future history and say, well, look at what a great guy Andrew Carnegie is, because he didn't even have to legally do that, but then he chose to do it. So this capitalist who you know, sort of had this ideological framework, he fucking, like, slashed every single person that he could throat, you know, that was competition. Right. And, you know, again, like, super efficiency, you know, he super efficiency'd. I'm using it as a verb. I don't give a shit.
That's a good verb.
But he basically, he changed the entire industry to fit his vision of it. Look at how great a guy he actually is in his heart of hearts, which nobody cares about anybody's heart of hearts.
Right.
So I don't know. Except for the people I know.
Really. I mean, it is impossible to know what somebody's heart of hearts is. So, like, why spend time worrying about it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like Elon Musk, like, pretending he's Tony Stark and being like, I'm going to fix the water in Flint. And he gives him, like, a bunch of, like, water filters that don't work. And he's like, I'm going to get those kids out of the cave. And he starts, like, getting all these lawsuits against him for being a dick.
Yeah, that motherfucker's doing it for the clout.
Yeah.
Is it possible that Elon Musk is the dumbest motherfucker that's ever walked the face of the earth?
Yes, it 100% is. In fact, we should, like, I've been joking about this for a long time, but we should just do, like, a deep dive on Elon Musk and just sort of, like, go step by step through the entire, maybe it'd be a multi-part series, maybe not, but, like, just going through that entire fucking grift. You know,
if you have any art about it, we should get like the old picture of him without good.
Oh my god, dude! All those guys though, like Bezos and Musk. You see, like what they looked like before, like they became billionaires and got like a CrossFit coach and like a fashion advisor. Yeah. Oh my god, that's a freak show.
Plastic surgeons.
Yeah, plastic surgeons. Like Elon Musk, like I don't have a good handle on what the backstory is, other than like his dad had like a South African like ruby
mine
or something.
Yeah, like some kind of precious gems.
Right. Like, and so I wonder if it's one of those things, like there was like one thing he was actually good at some point. But if you ever read, he's kind of an asshole, but do you ever read like the Black Swan stuff and like Fooled by Randomness by is it Nassim Taleb?
Uh-uh.
So he's like a big like quant like financial trader guy. Oh. And he writes like a real jerk. But he has a really great point where he says that in capitalism, like people make tons of money off of the volatility of capital.
Oh yeah, I mean that's and the whole financial crisis, Big Short thing.
Yeah, and so like you know, 99% of people involved in that don't ever make any money, right? Mm-hmm. Like a very small fraction do, and then we look at it backwards and look at the people who made it out of this volatility and say, well, what did they do right? They didn't do anything. They were just there, and it could have just as easily been somebody else.
Yeah, they're just the lucky motherfuckers.
The guy who won the lottery, like, must be the best guy at picking numbers, right?
Right, right. Yeah, he's very good at picking numbers. Yeah. So I think Elon Musk must be one of those guys, like, really good at picking numbers. And then all of a sudden, he's like, well, I'm going to solve traffic by inventing the tunnel.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm going to have a fucking, like, mass transit, but actually you're going to have to purchase tickets on the private market, you know? Yeah.
Right. I think it's really became clear when it was like, you know, a worldwide, it's a very small community, but a worldwide community of like emergency cave divers told him, you're wrong about this. He's like, no.
And actually, you're a pedo guy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're a pedophile.
I'm not wrong. You're a pedophile.
Right. But I think it's one of those things, like I see this a lot in society. And you mentioned the Joe Rogan podcast. I see this on there. I don't watch it much anymore.
Yeah.
But like where somebody is really good at one thing. And so, like kind of people assume that they know about lots of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Like they want to cross over from like successful billionaire to like Renaissance man.
Yeah. Oh right, yeah. Right. Like, oh, the guy that reminds me of that is the Whole Foods guy, the John Mackey guy. Is that his name?
Right.
Where he tried to like write a book on philosophy of life or whatever, what actually creates value in the world. And it was basically just Ayn Rand in different words with a different narrative.
Just tell me how much milk costs.
I know. That guy got rich. I was living in Austin back when Whole Foods, like I remember going in like that Whole Foods, that Whole Foods.
The Whole Foods. You know,
yeah, that guy got rich because he realized like people in that neighborhood in Austin would pay a lot of money to buy groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's why he's rich. That's about it.
And then the other side of it too, like once these people have established themselves, that's when you bring in your Don Draper, which is Scott's cue, to basically make it seem like you just act like this is the way the world is supposed to be and everything is just and everything is fine and you just want to get people to fucking consume at this point.
Yeah.
I think Madman reference isn't apt here, but has anyone seen Boardwalk Empire? That's just all about like people capitalizing on the fact that like they're gonna make booze illegal, and they just become all these like millionaires. And like, there's even one point where the main character like he has to do business with like John Kennedy's dad.
Mm-hmm. Right. And or referencing TV shows, I'll go with Deadwood. Like, if you want to understand capitalism, like watch Deadwood, right? Yeah.
That is actually like an idealization because it made like Al Swearengen seem like he was kind of socially responsible.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've never watched TV.
Oh yeah,
Al Swearengen. I don't watch any TV.
Like you know what he looks like. He's just like the grimy pimp cowboy character that you like.
The guy that's the brand of the show. Like Don Draper picked him to be the love hit of the show.
But like the big twist is that he's kind of got like a heart of gold and like all this civic responsibility.
Oh, fucking
like,
kill me.
He's like got a heart of gold, but he does murder his employees. So.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, look, you got to do what you got to do.
The actual real life guy, they're like, oh no, he's just a terrible pimp.
So, I guess maybe change gears a little bit in terms of the disaster thing and specifically with COVID-19. I know, and I you know, I don't usually do this, but I have read some of Naomi Klein's stuff, and she's been talking about, like, you know, historically she does a lot of stuff on disaster capitalism, and she was on Democracy Now! Talking about COVID capitalism that would sort of be what swoops in and takes it, you know, leverages this crisis into the next, you know, generation.
You're going to see it, man.
Yeah. So can you, like, I guess, what do you see on the other side of that in this sense?
I don't know. So Naomi Klein is, if you haven't read her, you should. I use her for my classes a lot. She has a great short essay called Iraq Year Zero. Mm-hmm. If you've never read it, I recommend it.
I've not, but
everyone.
I will.
Yeah, especially it's just short. About how, you know, when the U.S. went into Iraq, invaded Iraq, it brought all these, like, 25-year-old experts from, like, the every conservative think tank in Washington that were going to remake, you know, remake Iraq and their the image of how capitalism should just work freely and save,
like,
Iraq.
Project for a New American Century, people, right?
All that stuff. Yeah. And so here we are, what, how many years later? How many years have we been in Iraq? My entire adult life?
20 years. Yeah. 2020, so I guess 19 years?
I was actually there when the last convoy left.
Yeah, Scott,
really?
Scott was, he was in Iraq, you were in Iraq and Kuwait, right?
Yes.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, he was with the Air Force. He just got out last October, so he's
But you kept your Air Force
discharged.
Mustache. That's good.
No, this is not Air Force regulation.
He drafted that in honor of Ken Bone.
Oh, man.
I'm from an Air Force town, so I know all about the different versions of the Air Force mustache.
Oh, yeah, Herbert Fields.
Herbert's right there, between Eglin and Herbert.
Nice,
So, what was that? Oh, yeah, Naomi Klein. So, yeah, so disaster capitalism is kind of what she termed it, and it's a very real thing. She also wrote The Shock Doctrine, about how when these kind of shocks occur to a society, then there's the possibility of change, right? And so it depends on what kind of change that is. But if you're in position of power to increase your, like, grasp on how the economy works, then you're well positioned to, like, make money off of it and reposition yourself. So we see this with every disaster. I mean, you guys are from the New Orleans area. You saw this after Katrina, I'm sure. We know who what local figures got rich during Hurricane Katrina.
Sidney Torres.
That's exactly who I'm thinking of, right?
The worst guy
Sidney
in the world.
Sidney Torres. Yeah, sure. And, like, there's that, what's that big mansion on St. Charles? I was trying to figure out who owned it, and I looked it up, and it was, like, people who did garbage pickup after Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so, like, you know, we're seeing in Puerto Rico now. I know these people who are not great people who got contracts to go to Puerto Rico, and now they're, you know, millionaires doing whatever, like manipulating contracts between, like, one entity and another entity in Puerto Rico, and they're
buying water for a nickel and selling for a dollar.
Yeah, doing
and, you know,
selling
Puerto Rico
selling education to the state, which is another way of saying charter schools.
Yeah, and so, like, you know, is Puerto Rico, is your average Puerto Rican person better off?
They're worse. And, like, the Puerto Rican teachers were, like, the ones that were on the ground, you know, in the communities, and all the people who care about their kids in their schools were the ones that were literally on the ground, you know, getting tear gas during this whole thing, which I think Naomi Klein wrote another book about that, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's what you see over and over and over again. I give this, so I was, I recorded another interview, but it hasn't aired yet, I don't think, but I give this example a lot. After the, what year was the Boxing Day tsunami? 2006? It was after that killed 200,000 people in the Indian Ocean, right?
I think it was 05.
05?
I want to say 05 or 06, because I remember I was in college for that. I was at UNO, and I'm trying to, like, I'm dating myself. But
right,
I think it was, like, 05, 06.
You're dating yourself more than me. I was, like, working then. So, but so in Sri Lanka, right, the tsunami hit Sri Lanka really hard. And in Sri Lanka, along the beach, there were several kinds of developments. One were, like, really poor hand-to-mouth fishermen, like, shanty towns.
Yeah.
Another was, like, big concrete international hotels, right? So the tsunami hits. It takes out all these shanty towns. It hurts the hotels, but the building's still standing. The building's still fine because it's a big concrete hotel, right?
Right.
So the Sri Lankan government makes a law afterwards saying, look, there has to be a buffer zone, like a 1 mile, generally 1 mile buffer zone between, like, the beach and where we're going to build new housing because it's too dangerous to live there. The exception is if you have a structure that wasn't knocked down by the tsunami, you can leave it there, right? So fishermen's shantytowns gone, international hotels remain. And not only do they get to remain, they now have all this free beach next to them. It doesn't have poor fishermen.
And they have the capital to develop it.
Right. And yeah, they have the ability to say, let's reinvest in this. And, you know, kind of hand-to-mouth fishermen, like now you have to walk a mile to the beach. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, walk a mile to the beach, and like it would happen to you during the time of this disaster, even, right? How did you even stay alive? You know, like these aid nonprofits or whatever, or you know, whatever state programs or international programs come in and make sure that people are getting food, which things are absolutely necessary, but it's sort of like it perpetuates its sort of power dynamic as well, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And like, you know, and they ended up moving a lot of these people to flood zones, right? Mm-hmm. Moving away from the beach and put them in flood zones. And then, speaking of international agencies, you did have a lot of nonprofits, big nonprofits, come in, and they said, "Okay, we're gonna give you housing." And they ended up bulldozing all of these trees, right, to put in like prefab housing, and it gets like, you know, over 100 degrees there. And the fishermen used to sit out under their trees, like make their nets and stuff. And now it's like, well, now they're all stuck in their houses.
Yeah, that's the same shit that happened in the Ninth Ward, isn't it? Like they had made these stupid looking fish houses in after the storm, after Katrina. Remember that?
Oh, you mean the mayoral candidate Brad Pitt?
Yeah, Brad Pitt. That's right.
You know, last time I was down there, like how many of the Brad Pitt houses are condemned now? Like at least two.
I drive through there sometimes because I like to take Florida Avenue, and like that's the way I like to go. That place, like very few of them are still standing. Like it's, they're not condemned no more. They're gone. A lot of, not all of them, but a lot of them. And also they're ugly too. They're stupid, idiot houses.
They're not great. And some of them are by architects that I actually really like, but they're just like not great. And they didn't hold up at all. And like my complaint for years on those was they put these like working class at best families, like maybe working poor families in these houses with these high tech, energy efficiency systems like solar panels and all that stuff.
Yeah, things that are on their face good.
Yeah, and then expect the family to be responsible for like the financing the maintenance of them.
Correct.
Like, how is that possible?
You're giving them. It's just another way of fucking saddling somebody with debt, like student debt or like a mortgage debt or something else. Right. You know, that's just on top of all that. Brad Pitt. You
And it's one of those things, like, I don't know Brad Pitt, but it seems like Brad Pitt is probably a nice guy.
Yeah, he's well-intentioned enough, for sure. Like, that guy seems like he's whatever, but, I mean, there's just a certain, when you think about, like, how missionaries go into certain places and they develop influence for the church or whatever, like, there's an exchange and there's an ideology that's being sort of transferred and perpetuated when that happens. Not necessarily.
And they don't think it through, and they think, like, you know what people here want? They want, like, what me, a very well the architecture enthusiast would want.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's what they want.
Yeah.
Instead of asking them, like, you know, I've made this argument a lot, but like I've kind of tried to do, like, I'm not great at math, but I've tried to run the numbers on what it would have cost to just immediately build military, like base housing in the Lower Ninth Ward.
Dorms.
So my friend M.A. Sheehan, who's with the Lower Ninth Ward Home Ownership Association, when she gives a tour of the Lower Ninth Ward, she does where she drives down, you know, right at the line with the parish. There's the, is it Jackson Barracks? What's the barracks?
Jackson Barracks is the one that's on St. Bernard and...
Yeah, Jackson Barracks. If you go lakeside on that, there's a fence. There's a barbed wire fence between the Lower Ninth Ward and Jackson Barracks. There's base housing all over it.
Yeah.
It's all base housing back.
Yeah.
Well, right.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. But this, our point is the government can build housing.
Yeah. Right?
They know how to build housing. They could have built that across the Lower Ninth Ward and given everybody a house. They just chose not to.
Yeah. You hit on that's a really awesome point. And that sort of like shows a little bit of like, it kind of like tips the hand that like, even though there's all of this, like, you know, rhetoric around like capitalism is an efficiency based, framework and ideology. No, it's not about efficiency. It's for like the society. It's about minimizing cost. Again, the same thing, stripping the copper wiring or whatever, but like minimizing input, like in when you put your number in the magic number box and getting as big a number out, you know? It's not about consolidating costs on like the cost of the society. It's about leveraging that cost on the individual.
Yeah, and if we kind of put like neoliberal capitalism on top of that, mm-hmm. this is a good example of that because
can you define neoliberal capitalism for us?
This is great. I'll get in trouble. I should begin by saying neoliberalism is a contested term. Right?
Yeah.
So not every academic uses it in the same way.
So let me just give you a little bit of background because like that is actually something that I like. That's why I asked you that question because okay. I usually ask that question so I can like I think. Not using the term is not a great thing, but also understanding
right.
that it is such a contested term. That's why I ask right. so many people to define it.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe I can hear your definition of it.
Sure.
And sort of like, what's
and
the
I actually had to, my when I was writing my dissertation, my advisor, I think very correctly said, like, if you're going to use the term neoliberalism, you need to go back in and put in a section, like saying exactly what you're
meaning. Yeah, what you mean here.
So it's a contested term. And
what does it mean to you, I guess?
Hmm?
What does it mean?
I'll tell you the way that I use it.
Yeah.
Right. And I tend to go. David Harvey has a great brief history of neoliberalism. Is that it? Is it a PDF? Is available online. He's writes really clearly. Yeah. Doesn't get bogged down in it.
Great series on
neoliberalism. Marx. Essentially, there's two things. There's an ideology and there's like a set of like laws and policy. Right. And
correct.
One difficult thing is these things can be contradictory with each other.
Yeah.
Right? The ideology.
It's
they
not
don't
a simple thing.
Right. So the ideology is that you can do it on your own. Everybody's kind of, if you individually work hard enough, you can achieve these things. You should be self-sufficient.
Bootstraps.
And the government's role is to kind of make markets open and free and kind of keep the economy moving. But the government doesn't have any real kind of responsibility for you as a person.
Correct.
Right? And the way this works in policies is interesting because the main contradiction there is neoliberalism requires constant government intervention, right? It just requires constant government intervention on behalf of powerful interests, right? And so, but part of, and the part that I'm going to get to with this lower ninth ward example is that it requires every government service to be run through like a contractor, like run through secondhand. It actually runs through
public-private partnerships, charter schools.
Yeah, public-private partnerships, charter schools, yeah. So the government can't just do things. The government doing things is wrong. The mm-hmm. government using public funds to pay a private entity to do something is great. It's
yeah.
just okay.
Not really only good. Is it wrong, but it's also uh-huh. inefficient based on the assumptions that are kind of put in there, right?
Right.
The fact that charter schools can, and again, we're kind of like doing a long run up to this example in the Ninth Ward that you're saying, but like the idea is that if you're doing it with a contractor, that contractor is going to do all that they can to make sure that it costs the state as little bit as possible,
right.
and they're
yeah.
getting the most bang for our buck. But what it doesn't talk about is how much it costs to pay that contractor as well.
Right. And how much it costs to have sections of bureaucrats and technocrats
yeah.
who would, like, figure out which contractors to pay, who's going to pay what contractor, who gets which deal, who gets what deal.
And in certain situations, it eliminates the economy of scale, which means that if you're making big
right.
purchases and making big moves on the part of the
yeah.
state or any large entity, it doesn't have to be the state,
right.
Then you're able to bargain more efficiently or more strongly because
yeah.
of the fact that you can essentially make or break an entire industry or entire sector of the economy based off of that. So anyway,
right. and it hollows out the state, right? Mm-hmm. It hollows it out where it says like, this isn't things that we do anymore. This
yeah.
is, we don't do those kind of things. You know, we'll get to the lower ninth ward example in a second, but kind of broadly with Katrina, that's what happened because the Bush administration ideologically believed that it was not the government's job to do a lot of things. Right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden when the government had to do something, the government doesn't do those things anymore.
Right. That's why Brownie did such a great job.
Yeah, it employs subcontractors to do those
yeah.
things. And it turns out subcontractors can just as easily not do those things.
Yeah.
They don't have.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, so with housing in the lower ninth ward, like the thing there is like, so because the government was so committed to this ideology of neoliberalism, it couldn't just build housing. It had to say, all right, well, we can pay you money to pay a contractor, to pay subcontractors. To do this work.
That's
right?
a lot of middlemen.
Yeah, and if you know anything about the Road Home program, it was, I mean, it worked for some people. It really, really, really didn't work for a lot of other people and didn't work for society in a lot of ways,
yeah.
right? And so when I was looking into this, because my friend MA had given me this example, which I think is a great example of the base housing, I was trying to figure out how to, what the unit cost of base housing, because I grew up, you know, around base housing. I was in and out of base housing. It turns out, even base housing is not built by the military anymore.
Oh, absolutely not.
It's built by subcontractors to the military. And there is written in there, like, the only way you can have base housing built by the military is if you're in some situation where you cannot get local contractors to do it. So even base housing now is like part of the neoliberal state.
Holy shit. Have they contracted out the Army Corps of Engineers yet?
No, who knows? Who knows? But and if you've been in base housing like from the 60s and base housing from like the 90s, like you know the difference, right? Like base housing from the 60s, like these solid, I mean they're small, but they're really solid, well built buildings. Base housing from the 90s is like, you know,
it's like a house.
You know,
like,
it's funny.
It's just like a McMansion or whatever kind of.
Yeah.
And I think of it in a way to kind of like, if these subcontractors were all like organized, like with the building trades or with the unions or something like that, I would kind of be okay with it because that would be just a complete shift in power in the economy.
Well, yeah. I mean, if like the state had to negotiate with like the Carpenters Guild, right? That would be very different.
Yeah.
Right? But this also keeps all these contractors in competition with each other.
Correct.
All over the place,
yeah,
right?
they leverage against each other. And the building trade sort of like that's why. And like again, I'm a union guy defender until the end of the day. But and there's a reason that people think that building trades are like I don't believe this. But like there's this idea that the building trades people are like the reactionaries of the labor movement or whatever. And it's not because they are like necessarily whatever, but it's because they're fighting to survive with people who are just like cutting and cutting and cutting the floor lower and lower and lower and lower. So, I mean, it's just really fucking difficult to sort of like point a finger at people who are trying to, you know, feed their families. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, like between my master's degree and when I went back for a PhD, I could not get a job anywhere because this is like post 2008 economy. Like there's just no jobs. And so I worked construction for a while. Right. And you see that
hard work.
Yeah, I did. Oh, man, I had the most ridiculous. I did custom glass installation, which sucks. Like never do it.
Scott worked glass with Painters and Glazers for a minute. He was an apprentice and unfortunately got laid off and he kind of like he didn't stick with it. Or I'm not blaming you for anything or whatever, but like you changed direction and like that seemed like it was not an easy job, but it's also kind of like a super fulfilling job though in a certain sense.
Oh yeah,
right?
It was great.
Making shit is cool.
Like we just get the raw materials and they just like have a bunch of like mullion and be like, all right, well, here's what you have to do. And here are the measurements. And you just like construct the whole like frame and a windowsill and like, and then you'd like cut the glass and then you'd bring it to the site and you put it in and it takes 2 days.
Yeah,
that part's like, cool. The hard part is like in carpentry, if you're like a quarter inch off, you can make it work.
Oh,
custom
yeah.
glass, you're like a quarter inch off. You're done. You have to throw it out.
Glass don't work like that.
So stressful.
They used to tell me if you're going to mess up, cut it long.
Yeah.
Right.
You can grind it down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, but anyway, you were making a point about the glass now. I'm sorry. I'm Mr. Digression Man.
My digression was just like that in we're talking about construction and like why maybe they're the reactionary end of the labor movement. It's just like it's so highly competitive, like in a downward arc, right?
Yeah,
like because like
yeah, race to the bottom.
People I was working for were horrible people who would have done anything like just to get the cheapest labor possible.
Yeah,
just the absolute cheapest labor 100%. Possible.
Yeah,
and a lot of the people I worked with on the site are Mexican or Central American immigrants. Who are doing really good? They did like really solid work, and they're getting paid like garbage.
Dog shit,
to do it,
and they're feeding their family with it, you know, or they're sending it back to get their family to come here and be fucking like chased around by the state and thrown in the fucking camp. You know, it's like a cult, like the whole. And this is, I mean, I keep talking about Adolf Reed on this show, but like he does a really good job of saying that. He wants like there's this idea that we should have. I mean, like the capitalist idea is that. And he wouldn't even necessarily put it in these terms, but like the sort of like mainstream sort of like neoliberal idea, I suppose, would be that they want to have a class of workers with no rights and a class of workers who have just a little bit of rights and have them fight one another. And that's the way you keep them all down.
Yeah, I was going to say like my next remark about that was like so in Northwest Florida, because it's constantly building, it's construction, right? So you have all of these laborers from Mexico and Central America who are enabling this to happen by having really low wages, right?
Right.
But then you have people from Northwest Florida who drive around and see like where those neighborhoods that those people live in and say like, what are all these Mexicans doing here? Yeah. What are
they you working, know, and it's man. Like,
dude, your entire economy exists on their backs. Like, what are you talking about?
Exactly. Like,
you know, it's nuts. Anyway, well,
you don't want to point the finger either way because like working people are just like workers are working, right? Worker like the even like the you know lower crust, I suppose, of like the middle class or whatever. But like when you have when you sort of like pit these like slightly more privileged workers against right. the workers that are like literally thrown into cages with you know separated from their kids,
yeah.
you know by fucking brown, you know. I'm sorry, I'm getting into fucking inflammatory terms, but like you have people that are pursued by the state and surviving by the skin of their teeth and people who yeah. are surviving by the skin of their teeth, but they're not being chased by the state like that, you know? And it's just like, that is not your enemy, man. We're actually on the same side here.
Yeah. And that brings us like kind of around back to like neoliberalism is. So we talk about in academic terms, you talk about actually existing neoliberalism and like, what is it? So we have an ideology and policies, but what does it look like in reality? And yeah. that's what it looks like in reality.
Right, because the texts are like Adam Smith or whatever, you know, the Wealth of Nations and all these other fucking like abstract ideas, you know.
Yeah, but in reality, it makes people like you just people like there's a daily grind to get by, mm-hmm. and it just like you know immiserates people and alienates people and causes people to be in conflict with people who they should be in solidarity with, mm-hmm. and it makes a very limited amount of people a lot of money.
Yeah, totally.
While at the same time. Weakening the state, which could be responsive in situations, right?
Right.
And so, can I make an even bigger loop back?
Yeah, loop it. Let's make loops. Let's do some big loops. Let's thread some needles.
The bigger loop back is with COVID-19, with coronavirus that we're dealing with now, which makes me nuts. Is that you know there's a very concerted effort right now on the part of conservatives to say it's China virus, things
oh,
like that,
yeah.
to blame you know, and we can see what's going on there pretty clearly. But the crazy thing is, none of the people at the top, none of the people who are in the Republican Party right now in power, and I would say probably none of the people in China, want neoliberal, globalized neoliberal capitalism to end.
No,
right? they all want for goods and money to be able to move freely, quickly around the world, and they want for a technocratic elite of people to be able to move freely and quickly around the world.
100%.
As necessary to keep the system going
and to keep
right?
the workers down in the sense that like I mean like it's almost like it's another I'm just gonna spit a bunch of cliches but like right. it's like capital should be able to transcend borders workers mm-hmm. and human beings should
right.
not you know that's
right.
the
that's
way
exactly
the restrictions
right.
come in because that right. You know these nations that exist and I'm not like now I'm gonna sound like a fucking anarchist which I'm not and like I'm nothing against anarchists but like the idea that we have these nations with these borders they're utilized in such a way that
yeah.
you can limit the flow of how humans can follow where capital's going
right and so like with this situation like you know I follow Fox News grandma Facebook pretty like
yeah
I try to keep up with it to see what's going around.
I talk to my mother-in-law too.
Fortunately my mother-in-law is a Japanese farmer so
that's pretty cool.
Which probably means she's in the wrong political party here, too. But I won't think too hard about it. But Abe. Yeah, Abe. It's Abe. It's funny because the Conservative Party here is the Liberal Democratic Party. The
yeah. It's everywhere but America.
Right. Yeah, well, they promise they give us robust social safety net and health care and all those things.
Yeah, what a sons of bitches.
Yeah. But with, you know.
I know what you mean, though.
Global...
I'm not trying to minimize. Yeah. I know what you mean.
Hey, no, we globalize neoliberal capitalism, right? Like, we want this stuff to move around. And so, like, Fox News grandma Facebook is like, we know this is China. We know China did this. But there's no other point in their lives where they'll say that this system of just keeping people and things moving constantly around the world is bad. They support it completely, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, if you oppose it, you know, I want people to be able to move freely around the world. I don't care about goods and like capital.
I found that the most effective way to talk to my mother-in-law, the person I genuinely respect, right? But she does kind of like have that brain. Is
right.
to talk about it in those sort of like abstraction terms and sort of depersonalize and sort of like denudify
it. Of course.
And like when you sort of like lay it that way. And you don't even have to make the point at the end. You don't even have to just say, like, well, that's what's going on in the world, man.
Right, sort of
say, okay, cool, then we agree, and then the conversation's over. You know, that's sort of like that's what I end up doing.
I just abstract the argument to another country.
Yeah,
right?
yeah. And it's not like it's funny, not like the fucking like Sam Harris hypotheticals thing either, because you're talking about real stuff that's happening.
Right. Like, so like my dad is the most, like, I always describe my dad's level of conservatism is he honest to God doesn't think enough people got shot at Attica. That's his level.
Wow.
He's like that guy.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so like, and kind of racist, and sure. So not even kind of, but
whatever.
So
I'm from Shawnee, like, bro. I've heard it all.
Yeah, Northwest Florida is special. But when I talk about like how racism works in Japan, right, I'll be like, oh yeah, man, that's messed up. Japan, that's racist.
Yeah,
and it's like, yes.
How are they different?
Would you like to make the next step? Yeah. Like, make the next step there with me. Uh-huh. Like, we went to Hawaii for my sister's wedding. And I was like, look at you.
What's the reverse of a shout out?
Minority, what are you doing here?
Yeah. What's the reverse of a shout out? Because that, whatever that is, to Tulsi Gabbard.
Whisper in. I'm sorry. But yeah, no,
totally. Like the way like localized racisms work, you know, that is something that is, I mean, again, like, there are broad versions of it that sort of manifest locally, like race, like color-based racism, or like, you know, that kind of racism has broad implications, but how it manifests in different countries or even like different, like, you know, U.S. states is different, you know, especially in the modern sense. So like northern states in the U.S. have a different kind of relationship to racism than southern states in terms of history and context, right?
Yeah, which is something I didn't get until I lived overseas. I'd never lived outside of the South until I moved to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then speaking with like friends who aren't white from like up north, mm-hmm. it was like, wow, this is an interesting new kind of racism.
Yeah, it's like, wow, that is such a patronizing kind of racism.
Yeah. But what I was going to say about the, you know, the thing going on with calling it like trying to rebrand it, definitely trying to rebrand it as like a, something to do with China now is, I mean, to anyone who experienced Katrina, it should be obvious, right? Like, how do you cover up your own failures during a disaster by being a racist? Like
right.
Anyone who's looked at Katrina should like realize what's going on there.
Yeah. You
right?
just throw the red meat out.
Yeah, sure. I mean, how many, Jesus, man, there's this guy, how specific should I be? I don't want to implicate him.
This
guy I grew
up
with, really good punk rocker guy, one of those guys.
Yeah.
But like, I didn't realize he'd undergone some kind of change. And he like said to me, not to my face, because I probably would have punched him. He said to me over Facebook, like, well, he's like, well, I don't want to, you know, I don't really want to piss people off. But, you know, isn't it kind of people in New Orleans' fault?
Oh, no.
No, no. Like,
and, you know, it's like, you know,
what is that even? Is he Pat Robertson?
Yeah, but it wasn't even. But you know, and there's so much like racial stuff wrapped up in that. It's just crazy.
And again, there's like a the funny thing. And again, I don't like navigating like the like specific intricacies and nuance of like how racism functions is not one of my strengths, I would say. But I can say this, like there is extremely like an overload of racism that happens like in our society that we don't even fucking notice, and we kind of take it for granted. So like when we're sort of like navigating, we don't even know what assumptions we're making when we make decisions that we're doing that we sort of like think are woke or even or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially me, I'm a white person, right?
Yeah,
so
same.
Like I step on these landmines constantly, even when I think I'm doing the right thing. But you know, I also try to be grateful for people who tell me I'm stepping on these landmines.
Take people in good faith when they're telling you that when they're telling you, hey, you know, that was fucked up or whatever. Okay, cool. And like, you know, I don't usually, you know, I try to, and I'm not perfect at it either, but like I try not to get like pissed about it or whatever, and I'm just sort of like, okay,
right.
I'll take that into consideration and like reconsider and critique what I'm doing. I appreciate that, what you're telling me, right?
But that's a hard skill to learn, right? I think
it's
a hard skill to learn.
It's
right?
Humility in a real way. Yeah. And like, I'm getting a little bit uncomfortable just like in the, I don't know, I'm talking about myself too much, I suppose.
Yeah, stop talking about yourself. But, you know, I think it is good to talk about, like, to relate this back to the disasters, because race is always comes up in all of these things, right?
Yeah.
So, like, in the 2011, so my specialty. My dissertation is on the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan, right? So that's what I research. Interviewing people, there is still this persistent rumor that Chinese gangs were running through all of these. You know, these are fishing communities that are remote, that are have 10,000 people at best. Like, no one goes up there. That Chinese gangs were running through the wreckage, like cutting the fingers off of bodies to steal the rings and stuff. What? And I can tell people that that didn't happen. That really didn't happen. But
you want to hear something funny?
Yeah.
There was a rumor, probably people still say it, that during Katrina, a bunch of gangs from Texas like got a bunch of trucks and came down to loot.
Yeah, you hear stuff like that with Katrina all, like, there's wild rumors about Katrina, which I'm sure you know, like, wild rumors. And if you kind of like step back and think about what those rumors are telling you, a lot of it is that a town that is majority African-American is out of control, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If you're looking at the rumors in the tsunami in Japan, it's telling you that there's, like, you know, a fear of outsiders, and, like, the biggest outsider they can think of are, like, Chinese communities, right? Mm-hmm. But in the, when was the Great Kanto earthquake? There's a huge earthquake in Tokyo in the 1920s, before World War II, killed masses of people, yeah. right? And the rumor quickly went out that somehow Korean people is Korean people's fault. Korean people in Japan's fault.
How the fuck did that even make sense?
It doesn't make sense. And so Korean people were lynched in the streets. God. Like, so all these lynchings took place like right after the earthquake because people, this rumor went around, this racialized rumor.
Yeah.
And I don't know a disaster that's happened that hasn't involved like people quickly trying to put a racial frame on it.
So that's like the angle that you've taken up like in your work for the most part, or is that sort of just
that's just something I came across. Like mine, I look at like community participation and reconstruction.
Oh, that's beautiful.
But when you're interviewing people, right, people will just come out with this. Like, yeah, by the way, did you know that Chinese people were running through here? And then it's really hard as, you know, a qualitative researcher. It's not my job to say, no, you're wrong. That didn't happen. Right.
You take the data.
I can just listen to them. Yeah, I can't say it. I can't tell them. I mean, I guess I kind of could, but it's like, I will say like, oh, well, I'm not sure there's any proof of that or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're talking to people who that's like in their belief system. Now.
Yeah. And you don't, like, even if you weren't like trying to just like, again, like, if you weren't there to gather information, if you were a person talking to somebody, like, again, if it's somebody you know or somebody you don't know, how do you tell them that they're being a racist without turning them off of listening to you? Because that's a really fucking hard thing to do.
Yeah, in instances like this, I would explain the long history of
yeah, contextualize
the context, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and the horrible irony of this is that what we know about disasters is that people who are in oppressed minorities and racial minorities suffer worse, right?
Of course.
Like, you know, the Korean community at that time in Japan suffered under the earthquake, right? Like, mm-hmm. Not just Chinese immigrants, but all kinds of immigrants during the tsunami, like, had a hard time, right? Just because they spoke another language and weren't really integrated into the community. In the Kobe earthquake, in 1995, like, Korean neighborhoods were hurt worse because the fire department responded later, right? Or they weren't built well enough. So, like, the irony about all these things is that the racial context in which this happens also affects, like who is harmed.
Yeah, for sure. And whatever the response is, because, I mean, to make a sloppy comparison, I suppose, to the COVID-19 in the U.S. sort of situation, like the U.S. response, by the way, maybe it was uniquely bad, just sort of like in the particulars, but like part of what the sort of was common amongst responses is that it was essentially try as hard as you can to not acknowledge how much of a catastrophe this is until you have to. And then you get situations like fuck. And I'm not here to like praise South Korea or whatever, but they were the ones that were able to mitigate as quickly as possible because they have the sort of like structure in their society to make that take place. Right.
Where?
South Korea.
Yeah, you know, so I should clarify for everyone, like, I'm not an epidemiologist, like a public health person. So it's really hard for me to say, to make a judgment call on who did something right and who did something wrong. But maybe you're not even doing that.
But I'm saying, like, the sort of outcome, even based on based on, like, what the situation is. Right. Like, South Korea had significantly fewer infections and deaths than, like, Italy, for example. You know, for whatever reason, I suppose. But I think
I think we'll find out a lot more about that stuff later on. Like, this is going to be decades of research on this stuff, right? But I will say, in relation to, like, the U.S., right, like, having a robust social safety net, having very good health care.
Medicare for all, baby.
Is huge, right? It's huge in these situations. And all of us who've been pushing for Medicare for all forever, like, know that.
Yeah.
You could see this.
That's why we're doing it.
Yeah, that's why we're doing it. Right? I mean, absolutely, what we're.
I mean, like, go ahead. I'll finish. I'll wrap it up later. I'm sorry.
These are the reasons that you have social safety nets, right? Mm-hmm. And we've been hearing from Republicans and mainstream Democrats alike that this is about free stuff, and it's like, no, it's about, I know what's going to happen, right? We can see what's going to happen if we don't have this, and we need it in place to have a society. And one thing that always gets me, having been in America the last 8 years and then just moved back to Japan, is I forgot what it's like when now I don't have to talk myself out of going to the doctor, right? Like, in America, I do everything I can to not go because
you don't want
to
pay the 25.
I don't know what kind of bill I'm going to catch, right? Yeah. So, like, the other day, something, I can't remember, but I was saying, like, oh, I should really see the doctor about this. And my wife's like, well, why don't you just go to the, there's a doctor across the street. Why don't you go there? I'm like, okay, well, like, how do I make an appointment? She's like, what are you talking about? Just walk across the street and go to the doctor. I forgot how to think like that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember how to think.
There are
like
places
that
in the world where you don't have to, like, jump through fiery hoops to go to the doctor.
Right. Yeah. Or make like, you know, well, this year was really hard for me. Of like, you'll let me pay you like a duck that I caught. The doctor, right? And I have to think that when we look at this later, like, having a society who isn't conditioned to not seek medical care, right? Like, just think, in America, how many people have untreated underlying conditions right now, right?
My God, most people. I mean, maybe not most people.
I
went most of my life, and this is not like a life or death sort of thing, but it is sort of like a personal thing in terms of, like, but I didn't get diagnosed with ADHD until I was like 33 years old or something like that, right? And you know, if my mom's listening, I'm not diagnosed with ADHD and I don't take meds, but it's one of those sorts of things. Like, again, I'm not trying to, like, compare it to somebody who's got like a life or death situation, or that somebody's got like a real dangerous thing, but I do notice that, like, quality of life, and this is a material thing. Yeah. I can make it a fucking, I can put it in capitalist terms if I want to, right? Yeah. I am a more productive, you know, person as a teacher or whatever when I'm on my meds than when I'm not. So give me my fucking meds, right?
Right. Absolutely. Like, I, now that I'm back in Japan, I've had, for the last 8 years in America, I had one wisdom tooth left and it was rotting.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get it out, and they wanted to charge me like $400, $500 to get it out, which I never have that much to spend.
No.
And I came back to Japan and I paid like $15 and got it taken out, right? And so, is that a huge deal in the course of my life? No, but it could be, right? To have an infected tooth, to have something.
And it's good, like, to not be hurting all the fucking time either.
Yes. And that's the thing. Like, you're expected to be, to kind of take on all of this, like, to do labor and then to take on all of the pain, all of the injuries that come with it, and to just, like, well, that's life. Right.
Yeah.
And that's part of the idea. We're talking about the ideology of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
That's the ideology.
That's boomer talk.
Right. And, you know, you'll meet people across America who will tell you that, who will be like, oh, yeah, well, I wanted to go to the hospital. I got a story. I was in Metairie at a crawfish boil. Of course, it happened in Metairie. I was at a crawfish boil. And it was kind of, it was last year when I was kind of in the heart of Mardi Gras. So I was already like, I can't tell if I was hungover or worn out, but I was drinking.
Nobody knows in Mardi Gras. It's just one big blur. Yeah.
It was a big blur. So I didn't really have the energy to argue with this, but there's a guy I kind of like, but he's a super Republican. And he was like trying to talk to me about healthcare. And I wanted to be a good advocate for healthcare, but I didn't feel like having the conversation.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, you know, I could see how Medicare for all could be okay, but you really don't want people, like, I mean, it'll just make people kind of like lazy, and they won't take care of themselves. And it's like, dude, you don't. Healthcare isn't punishment. Yeah. It's not like discipline for
it's
people.
God,
right?
It's God's way of saying like you should have gone to the doctor or whatever the fuck, or you should have worked harder.
Remember when you were a kid and like going to the dentist was the worst thing? Like that's, people keep that fucking attitude. Like,
well, that's right. Literally. So to make a historical comparison, I suppose like that's sort of like the John Smith idea, also of like you work or you don't get fucking fed. You know, like, and it goes all the way back to the like, you know, early English colonies in the U.S. where, you know, they were entities to turn profits. That was the point of them, right?
Right.
And basically it's work or die was the founding. That's one of the founding ideologies of America, isn't it?
Right. No, I remember celebrating Thanksgiving in elementary school, and I thought they were like school cool hats and stuff.
Right. And lots of feathers.
Buckle.
And...
yeah, buckle. That's good.
Yeah, you take your... You take your belt, your buckle off, and the brim falls off.
I was about to make another digression, but I don't want to keep you going off course. But
no, I mean, just another one, we got
conservative
chill, man.
Facebook arguments I bumped into earlier this year, which is where someone's saying, like, you know, we shouldn't have Columbus Day anymore because this, and all these, like, local conservatives in Destin were on there saying, like, well, we really don't know if the early people in America got along with the Native Americans or not. Like, that's so long ago. There's no really way for us to know. There's a historical record.
Buddy, yeah.
Right? We kind of do know.
Yeah, that's kind of the big has anybody thing ever in the past, like, things? 5 years to be like, oh, there's, like, proven science. Well, you know, maybe that's not true, you know?
Maybe that's not true. Maybe, yeah. Who knows?
It's almost like the Futurama thing. I'm just a country, you know, what was it, like a rooster or something like that when he was the lawyer? To make a really dumb cultural reference.
Yeah, it's like almost like the kind of like the, like the new age like movement where it's like, what if all the things you thought were not real? But then like, then people like take it to the extreme where they're like, oh, well, here's all these proven things. What if atoms are just made up for some reason? Why would you? They just want us to believe in atoms.
Well, it's funny. This is one place where horseshoe theory is accurate. Yeah. It's like the being completely uneducated and then being completely overly educated come back. Like, yeah. Where you get the highest level of academia, it's the same question.
Yeah,
like,
you do. Yeah.
What if we don't know anything?
I like to call that head ass theory. It's just you put your head in the air and then you just kind of keep going around until it's right up your fucking ass.
Yeah. When I was in grad school, the guy who taught us statistics and the guy who taught us research methods is the same guy. And he's really, really good at statistics, like really, yeah. Really good. And so a statistics class, he's teaching us all these formulas and stuff, and he's teaching us. And then a research methods class, he's like, I know I teach you that, but I have to tell you something. I don't think that we know anything. I don't think we actually know anything. I don't think there is a way to know anything.
He's, yeah. Like, all right. So, like, you know, that's a really great thing. And that's, like, we could talk about academia if you want to, because that's one of the, like, wow. Kind of fun things. Because one, people don't realize this. Most people don't realize this. Maybe if you're listening to the sound of my voice, but like academia is a fucking business. That's what it is right now, right?
Oh, I went to Tulane. Oh, yeah, you're right.
And the other thing is too, like when you like what you were just saying, like this idea, I'll kind of like wanted to kind of zoom in on that a little bit. Like, yeah. Once you start to get to the point where you know so much about one specific thing, you start to, like, that becomes your life and you dissociate from other things that are, like, what other people's experiences are, which are grounded in reality in other ways, right? So what ends up happening is you're just, like, shooting off into this fucking direction where you start talking, and I'm probably guilty of this, and I'm not even an academic, right? But, like, you start, like, shooting off on, like, this thing or that thing or the other thing that nobody fucking understands. You're talking to them for 45 minutes, and their eyes just turn to glass. And then they're, it's just like, man, what the fuck? I'm just trying to eat crawfish here, you know?
Yeah, I kind of referenced this earlier when I was talking about the Joe Rogan thing. It's a problem that I see not on that show and a lot of other kind of like podcasts like that. Whereas if somebody is a PhD in something, right?
Yeah, they know about everything.
They have to talk about all these other things, right?
Like Jordan fucking Peterson.
Like Jordan Peterson, who is what? He's like a psychologist,
psychology
right?
Professor.
Like an addiction specialist.
Yeah.
Right. So the other stuff that he's famous for, it's cool, I guess, that he know. I don't like him, but yeah. Like whatever. It's a hobby, right? That's yeah. not his specialty, right?
I'm a genius of sociology, and it's the whole entire narrative of the history of the world is West versus East. You know?
Right, right. Or like someone like Sam Harris, whose like PhD is like
neuroscience. Something about,
yeah, brain image scans of people looking at like religious texts.
Yeah.
But then he's like supposed to be taken seriously and all this other stuff. Like, and I'll say that for myself, like, right? The more you get into your PhD research, the less you know about like mm-hmm. everything else. Like, I know a lot about the thing that I know about.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it now, right? That's right. about it. Like, I knew more about other stuff when I was a junior high school teacher, right? Because you have to, right?
Actually, I did want to ask you about that because I did not know about that about you until yeah. you posted about on Facebook like today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know you taught like junior high. That's fucking that, and that's one of those because I teach fourth and fifth grade special ed, right?
Yeah.
I'm feeding my kids to what you used to do, and like that yeah. kind of period is so interesting to me because like I'm a teacher, right? Uh-huh. And I'm like, well, especially the fifth graders, like
yeah.
the coolest thing about fifth graders, I think, is the fact that they don't give a fuck that I know how to teach them how to do fractions. They're just like, well, fuck you. I'm like, they're not even necessarily doing it for the grade, especially like in my kind of class. They're just like, no respect for anything. I got mad respect for that. Like, kids are cool because they don't give a shit.
Yeah, teens are rough, man.
So you'll probably understand this when I tell you, but like, I think different people are cut out to teach different ages. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. Oh, 100%.
I think I would be a garbage elementary school.
It's
teacher.
Hard.
Like, I don't think I could do elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
But I love teaching junior high. And I know a lot of people who are like, fuck that, man. And
yeah.
I understand why. But like junior high school kids are, the thing I like about them is that they're not adult enough to be like, I don't need to talk to you. I don't want to have anything to do with you. But they're not kids enough to be like kids, right? They
don't need
like
a hug.
Yeah, and they're kind of just horrible shits, right?
Yeah.
But it's funny if you accept them as horrible
yeah,
shits.
Of course.
Like, and they're like, man, all right, I see that. And like, I think maybe for me, like, I remember being that age. I very remember.
Yeah,
remember
being that's where age. All of your hormones happened.
Yeah, and like, I can kind of like figure it out. But yeah, that's what I did. Like, but I was in Japan, so I taught for 10 years in Japan. And
no,
we could do a whole nother episode about that because what I taught at really rough schools in Japan, which people mm-hmm. don't think that there are.
Like so low socioeconomic status, like that.
Well,
kind of
it's hard because you would think like the worst school I ever worked at, we tried to figure that out, what it was. And it wasn't their parents. I mean, there were some kids who were really hard up, but there were other people who were very well off financially. It kind of breaks down a little bit differently.
They don't really have the private school system either that the U.S. has. Like, the U.S. has a fucking
well, they do,
brutal...
They do and don't. Like, it's weird. Like, there is a private school system. There's not a charter school system.
Right.
But people who go to private schools in Japan tend to be kids who did worse in school, and they don't have an option to get into the good public school. They didn't test well enough to
so
get into it.
It's reversed.
It's reversed.
Uh-huh. Because
yeah.
in the U.S., I mean, like if you have money, your kid goes to private school, like
right.
period.
Yeah.
And like even middle class people can send their kids to yeah. private school, but it kind of hurts, right? But like,
yeah.
but then now we've started like cutting into these. We have sort of like built this model of like, and I kind of like call it a brain drain in a sense where we kind of like send wow. kids to magnet schools and all these other things.
Yeah.
But like the private school system in the U.S. is a point like that is a. Elite
right.
social reproduction.
That creates elite society, right?
Elite
creates
social elite reproduction.
Society.
Yeah.
But
in
I don't
Japan,
be,
you say
in
it's
some places in Japan, that is true. Like if you're in Tokyo and you grow up in an elite family in Tokyo, you're expected to go to an elite preschool, right?
Yeah.
From all the way
from,
through.
Yeah, from the
like,
moment
in
you're
general
born.
In Japanese society, so I'm going to blow your mind on this one too. High school is not compulsory in Japan. So
okay.
people think of Japan as being this like everyone's in school and it's very strict. You are only required to go through junior high.
Okay.
And I think I've seen the statistics before that are kind of nuts, but I'd like to check them again. It's like, I think a very large percentage of the population did not go to high school, but you
really?
Do then have like a pretty robust trade schools. Right.
That sounds awesome. So like, actually
there are, it's very, so here's the thing. Like when I was teaching these really rough schools, I would have these mainly boys who would be like, I can't do school. I know that I hate school. And I would tell them there's nothing wrong with being like a plumber's a good job. People need plumbers, right? People need HVAC specialists.
Our fucking society dies without plumbers.
Yeah, people need like the guys who build the scaffolding on the construction site. Like these are, and if you don't like school, like
God bless, know that now. Yeah.
Go. And so a lot of those kids who had a rough time in school, like left, maybe some of them like fucked around for a few months, but then they went to trade school and got a trade job, which great. Good for them, you know. You know,
yeah, that's kind of like not how it is at all, because like going to school in America, it's like, oh, you're not going to college? Well, yeah. Get ready to fucking eat shit for the rest of your life.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, it seems,
or go to college and eat shit for the rest of your life.
No, you eat more shit, potentially. Like, if you, like, right. I mean, that goes to, like, the student debt fucking thing. And it's actually insane. I did want to circle back to one other thing, too, when it comes to, like, I'm circling way back again. But when it, like, comes to, like, society and, like, what we prioritize in these disasters, too, you can see because, like, this is changing gears. But there was a report that I saw, and I didn't read much past, like, the lead in the first couple paragraphs, but the U.S. government has determined that, like, the point at this point, we're going to start giving money to banks to lend to, to the point of, like, $1 trillion a day, right?
Yeah.
The entire student loan debt combined, I mean, all school student debt holders, which is an anchor on the entire working class in terms of spending money, is like $1.6 trillion. That would
it needs to be gone now.
And you could just snap your fingers, it's fucking disappeared. You don't even need the Secretary of Education to sign off it. You could get the fucking Fed to do it, right?
Did you hear the weird like pretense the way they gotta do about it? They have to like create a platinum $1 trillion.
That's just stupid, but U.S. law.
But that's been out for a while, and like I don't know why you don't like. So this is one of the frustrating things about like sociology. And I tell my students when they come in, like sociology is good because like when you start to understand it, you'll start to think about society. But it's a curse because you'll never be able to like see
terms
like real again, right? So everything, all money is completely imaginary. Yeah. There are people who will argue with me about this, but I'm gonna, that's the hill I'll die on.
You would agree with Jake, who's been on the show a couple times talking about like Yang and MMT, but go on.
Yeah, MMT is fine, it's good. It's imaginary, right? We only give it value in our minds, right? It's completely made up. And so like people say $1 trillion coin and think it's funny, but it's like, well, what is a nickel coin? Are there like 5 pennies inside of it?
Mm-hmm. No, totally.
Like, so it's $1 trillion coin. Look, that coin, look, this is worth $1 trillion. Okay, fine. And if the government says that, it's true, right? I
kind of like when these kind of conversations come up, too, with the $1 trillion coin, because, like, it's sort of like, and you can start talking about, like, what is currency and why is it valuable, right? And even if you're, like, talking to fucking Rand Paul about the gold standard or whatever, and, like, if you asked him why is gold valuable...
Yeah, right. Why is gold valuable?
Why, especially in a 20th century? In the 20th century,
it's really good on the RCA hookups if you're a soundophile.
Yeah, exactly. Because gold's got a low fucking melting temp or something, and you can like make it into other fucking things. Who gives a shit about that? Like, who can fucking smelt gold right now? It's the only point of it is to exchange it. That's what currency's for.
I mean, the diamond exchange is just like hoarding diamonds so that they could give them back like with nothing. And like we should be using it for like drill bits and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Totally. A diamond's use value is it as a drill bit. Right?
Yeah.
That's about it.
Gold is in its melting point in conductivity, right? Just like copper or something like that.
Right.
But somehow for some reason fucking copper is way less valuable than gold. Why?
And someone I've heard, like the only semi-persuasive argument I've heard is that gold in its scarcity and distribution across the earth is like a good stand-in for what value would be. But it's like, okay, that's also made up.
Somebody just said, wow, there's not a lot of gold. Let's make it important.
Right. Yeah, you know, I don't know. Do you read or listen to Richard Wolff at all?
Richard Wolff, yeah. He's cool.
Richard Wolff's great. And like he writes about like how, you know, economics departments are set up to be kind of cheerleaders for this system.
Yeah.
So when you say things like this, right, you'll have economists be like, oh, this is why sociology is ridiculous. I have all these equations that prove that money is real. And it's like, no, you have that whole like kind of technocratic system is set up to like convince you.
Yeah, you're doing it after the fact, dude.
Yeah, it's after the fact. It's like
you're working from where you're at now, and you're being ahistorical as opposed to going to the history and then going working from there to do the context. Not necessarily that like either one on its own merit is particularly invalid, but like right. without, and maybe I'm balancing here and call me out on it if I am, okay. but like both of these sort of perspectives are important to have the proper context, because like how you view something, how something originated it and how it functions now yeah. and how it's functioned throughout that time is what's important to tell you where you're at. And if you're just kind of like cherry picking which points right. you know help you fuck an argument or whatever, then you're not doing anything other than justifying your position.
Yeah, and so I should clarify, like I think that economics can be really, really useful to understand how our world works now.
Totally. I mean, Richard Wolff is an economist.
Yeah, and political economies can be really, really useful in understanding how the world works as it is, right? But the hard thing for economics to do is to take itself and say, like, okay, we understand that this is, assuming all of these other things in power dynamics, this mm-hmm. is how it works. But we could also just not have that, right? And it right. seems to be incapable of stepping outside, aside from some economists like Richard Wolff, you know,
right.
who are able to say, like, we could just as easily not have this system.
Right. Well, he's a political economist more than anything. Like, he understands political economy more than anything. Like, right. that's those.
I've got right here on my desk, I've got, where is it? He's in this volume. It's so funny. Richard Wolff's in this volume of, like, Reconsidering Gramsci. And then it's the same one that has Pete Buttigieg's dad on it.
That's awesome. Yeah. I don't know how much time you have free, but I mean, if you got to bounce, that's cool. But
I'm good for now. It's up to you guys.
Oh, I mean, I can talk to you fucking forever, man. But
before
you don't want to commit to that.
Before we get into anything serious, I did do glass at the Tulane basketball stadium.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. That's some nice glass.
Yeah, good glass. Yeah. Like the backboards?
No. The top, like at the top the stairs, there's like a weird place where there's like a fridge back there or something like
I
that.
I love it, man.
It's kind of weird. I did my undergraduate at Alabama and then graduate at Tulane, and there's a whole discussion to be had in that. But
some Roll Tide.
Like Alabama,
you're tied and a wave.
Yeah, I tied in. It is. I was got a tide and a wave. And I researched tsunamis.
Red go. And green, you fucking Christmas tide wave.
But like, so I feel like in Alabama, I probably went in like every building on campus, like every sporting event, all that stuff. Tulane, like I've never been in the basketball stadium. I went in the football stadium once to like watch a Saints practice. Right. Yeah. I don't know. And I was there for 8 years. Like I don't know. Yeah. It's weird. I've never been there. But I will say like, I'm very glad to not be in America right now, but I do, as much as Tulane makes me nuts, I do miss being on the Tulane campus.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you don't miss it because you go to the hospital, you son of a bitch.
That's true. That's true. I go to the dentist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess another question that I could ask is how is the COVID situation kind of hit in Japan specifically? Because I mean, in the U.S., you don't really hear about where it affects people, and other than like these extreme situations, like you hear about China and you hear about South Korea and you hear about Italy, but you don't really hear about places that like Japan or other things. So how is the COVID-19 kind of hit y'all?
This is very controversial right now, and people are picking sides on this. So Japan, by all measurements right now, has somehow dodged the bullet, right?
Cool.
So on the graph, Japan is just...
like a little hump, right? Yeah.
Not even a hump.
Yeah, cool.
People like me, whose job it is to freak out about this stuff, are saying, I would love for that to be true. I'm unable to accept that is true. Yeah.
How many people are y'all testing?
Not much. Okay, so Japan has decided to do a different approach. So this is what's on TV every night, where the Japanese government has said, we realize that we're not testing. I'm going to try to give the fairest approximation of both sides.
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
So the Japanese government has said, we know that we're not testing very much, but that's because we're doing a different approach, which is to identify clusters, right? Identify where they are, where they came from, test there, restrict those clusters, right? And we're trying to manage these clusters. So like Hokkaido, the most northern island of Japan, was like shut down for a month, right?
Yeah.
Boom, a cluster was brought up there. They went on emergency. And they're going to take off the emergency there this week, I think. Mm-hmm. there is a cluster now that they're really worried about between Osaka and Kobe, which is near where I live. They ask people not to travel between them. There's a cluster there.
Oh, they're bringing checkpoints back.
We'll see. So, well, it's funny. The NHK was interviewing people last night who were going between the two on the train.
Yeah, NHK is a news network out there, yeah, right?
The BBC of Japan.
Yeah,
except worse.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but for the context of our audience, like that's,
yeah, sorry.
No, you're good.
I forget not everyone watches NHK. So they're interviewing people, and this one guy, he's like, "Well, I heard, yeah, I know they're taking it very seriously, so I just went over to Osaka to run some errands and came back to Kobe."
Yeah.
I'll get to that in a second. But it's possible, right? And I'm very worried about this, that Japan has convinced itself that it dodged the bullet,
yeah,
and so it's setting itself up. For
especially with how this thing works, because it's like dormant stage.
It erupts so quickly.
I haven't been outside. Well, I've been like to the store, but I haven't been like to my job in about 5 or 6 days. And wow. I worked on St. Patrick's Day, and it was fucking packed. Like, we thought people were gonna stay home after all the news. Like, the mayor was like, "Y'all gotta stay home," and all these people were just like, "Fuck it!" It's like so packed, and like, so I've been sitting around for a week, just assuming I have this like disease.
Right. Right.
And I'm still paranoid. Like, I was like feeling tired today, and it's like, oh man, am I feeling temperature? I like started feeling hot, and I was like, oh no, it's just getting hot outside, and I keep my windows open, like, yeah, freaking the hell out.
I had that a week ago. I thought I was like, I got really tired. I was really dragging. I had a cough, like my nose was all stopped up, but I never got a fever. And so like, I think it's probably like hay fever.
What a fucking horrible time of year for an epidemic to hit that has those symptoms. Yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
I got a pretty, I had like runny nose the other day, but then it was just like, nope, pollen season. Like, I'm just really scary stuff. Mm-hmm.
It is scary. And so that's the one side of Japan. So the government and people are saying that's the way it's being managed. And then people like me are like, but, and so it's just coming into Hanami season in Japan. Hanami is where all the sakura, the cherry blossoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
beautiful.
Everyone goes and spreads out like blue sheets on the ground and has picnics and sits around under it. And the parks will just be packed full of people.
They're
right?
beautiful trees.
Beautiful. It's a great time of year. Everyone looks forward to it. We've been looking forward to it. Right. And so there's places where they're asking people not to do that, but then there are places all over where there's just masses of people. But, you know, I was out yesterday. We live near the riverside, and there's a huge, like, the riverside is all a park in Kyoto. And so there's been people out all over the place. But, you know, on the news, what they're saying is that the places where these clusters are popping up are places where there isn't good air circulation. People are in really close quarters with each other and are kind of in contact with each other. So I think a lot of people have been heeding that advice and going outside where it's kind of nice weather and breezy. And so it could completely be that Japan has dodged the bullet. I remain skeptical because it's my job to be skeptical.
No, but totally. But I hope your skepticism is unfounded, but I also think that it's important to remain vigilant so that when this sort of like optimism that I fucking terminally have, you know, is proven at least in some, you know, sense to be wrong. That the action that can be taken is, you know, mitigates as much as possible. And the only way that can be done is fucking testing, right? Anytime somebody's got a fever and starts displaying those symptoms, you need to have those tests to be available. And if you think that you have those symptoms before you even get the test, you need to fucking isolate. You need to fucking
I was thinking about getting tested today, and I heard that a thing got set up at the Mahaley Jackson Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's just for people who are in first responders and
That's not even the case. I told the people that I worked with, and they were like, they're out of tests. Like they were close, and they're like, oh, they're out of tests. I'm like, shit. But it's crazy because the reaction to all these things, like, I mean, you live in Japan where there's an aspiring nationalistic government.
Yeah.
Where
that's a way of putting it.
So maybe you guys kind of dodged a bullet there, but like here in like England, where they're just responding to it the absolute worst. England have probably had an even worse response than us, but they were like herd immunity.
Yeah.
Katie Hopkins was like chickenpox parties, just like that. And like they were like, oh no, hundreds of thousands of people will like die. They'll die in droves. Like,
and you know, the thing with them is we haven't even talked about, we can talk about this now, but the response to it. But like in England, they said we're gonna go with this herd immunity approach, right? And then in the middle of it, after they'd already started that, they decided to go back. And it's like, you can't, that's not how it's gonna work.
The one
thing they have done in recent days is even the super conservative British government has decided to just start paying people, right?
80% of their salary.
Yeah. Wow, they've got it scaled to salary. I mean, I'm not for that necessarily either. I mean, just give people fucking, you know, a flat amount. I mean, it's way simpler that way, right?
We still don't even know when we're getting our money because we keep hearing different things. We keep hearing, oh, like April 13th, but then it's like, oh, they got other bills going through and shit like that.
At this point, the fucking only thing that can prevent us from getting anything is the Democrats right now.
That's the fucking frustrating thing.
It's so crazy.
We can talk about this if you want to, but it's making me insane.
Yeah.
Which is that the initial bill that Maxine Waters and Katie Porter put out, it should absolutely have been passed as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And the Democrats are sitting around worrying about how do you means test.
Yeah,
but nobody cares.
How do we means test? How is this going to impact the budget? The least consequential questions. I don't give a fuck. I'd probably give less, probably give more of a fuck than like Bill Gates about getting that $2,000. Like that $2,000 or whatever that motherfucker is going to get is a drop in the bucket that he wouldn't even notice.
And if rich people think it's too much, they can do something else with it, right?
Yeah,
and we can
exactly.
tax them. We can tax them later, right?
Yeah, fuck yeah.
No,
that's right. We talk about the ideology of neoliberalism, right? And that is the ideology of the Democratic Party. Right?
Yeah.
There's no way around
that.
Oh,
yeah.
And so,
easy to get outflanked on the left by the right-wing party when you're fighting your own internal left.
Now.
Yeah,
right.
They're all being, because they're fighting off fucking Bernie Sanders, who's running for president on a left agenda. They've all consolidated and saying, you're full of shit, your ideology sucks, and then Republicans just swoop in and say, like, actually, y'all are fucking psychos.
I mean, that's the weird thing about like Bernie kind of, I mean, like the president kind of like copying off of Bernie's page is that the Democrats are obviously going to buck and just be like, oh, we can't let Bernie get this like dunker like on
Bernie
us.
Bernie and
like,
Trump are the same, man.
Yeah, it's just like this whole thing, like the people that are running the Democratic Party are like Tom Perez and like Chuck
Nancy
and like, Nancy and like they're fucking fossils. Like they don't understand what's going on. Like
they know exactly what they're doing.
They haven't lived shut up, Jeff. They haven't lived in the real world in so long.
Well,
it's just
true.
Like
that's true.
Like they don't understand actual like things.
Unless anyone think we're being morbid by playing politics over this, I said this on Facebook the other day, but like when I taught sociology of disasters in the Homeland Security School at Tulane for a while, right? The first lesson in every class is all disasters are political.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely political, right? Because politics is moving around material resources, right? And arguing about that. That's absolutely what they are. So when we're arguing for different politics, we're arguing for different versions of doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've been a Sanders supporter for a long time, but I'm not just saying he has the right approach because I'm a Sanders supporter. Like, it's the opposite of that. I support him because this is the right thing. Like, this clearly has to be done. And the problem here is that I don't know why mainstream Democrats do not understand this. Is that fascism is very, very good at appearing to be like left-wing populism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if Trump says, I'm cutting everybody checks tomorrow, well, fuck it. The Democratic Party's done. They don't have anything to do with this anymore, right?
Yeah, the choice literally is socialism or barbarism because liberalism is not a choice that anybody in their right fucking mind would make.
That's it. And you know, what is their answer for this? If you're honest to God, like, thought is how do we means test this? Like, get out of politics, right? Like, that's not what's going to happen right
you're
now.
You're not in any kind of connection with humans. Like, you don't know what human emotions are. You're a robot.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm going off way too hard, maybe. But, I'm so mad about this.
Yeah, no, it's kind of making me nuts. I was trying to not be nuts about it. What finally pushed me over the edge has been Barack Obama's human interest tweets all day. The edge, which is like, here's a positive story about something happening, and he's retweeting like Andrew Sullivan.
The worst.
Yeah, like
while he's like fucking parasailing with Richard Branson or something.
Yeah, it's so weird seeing like him just become like the person everybody liked to just being like, I'm not going to take part in any of this process. I just want to be this weird political kingmaker.
That is what he did as president, though. It's the exact same stuff he did as president. But he like, just always just sort of like did the, well, the professionals are going to handle it, you know?
Like, he like never, ever distanced himself from Rahm Emanuel, who's like maybe one of the worst people.
I was trying to like, so I really hate Facebook and I've gotten out of doing it, but I'm trying to be very vocal right now to like have people convince their friends that this is serious.
Yeah.
But so one conservative guy from Florida was yelling at me. He's like, you don't dislike this. You think this response is bad because Donald Trump is doing it. It's like, dude, you should have heard me like when Obama appointed Timothy Geithner, right? Like, and I have voted enthusiastically for Barack Obama. And as soon as he appointed Timothy Geithner, I'm like, this is the worst cabinet pick in the history of the world, including Donald Rumsfeld,
exactly. There's it's just making a lazy argument just to be lazy. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't want to get too much like head up your own ass theory on this because like I swim in these waters probably more than most people, and most people do probably think in those fucking like very face value terms, and that's why I find deep like you were talking about this earlier, and it's a really good point, and I agreed then, and I agree now, like depersonalizing these things as much as possible, and sort of like laying them out in sort of like these bare abstract, not well maybe not bare abstractions, sort of like these less specific, I suppose, in less personal terms, is helpful because people just, when you say these fucking words, their brain turns off and they get defensive.
Right. Yeah. Do you mean that about Barack Obama? Or
oh, definitely about Barack Obama. Like, Barack Obama is still beloved for no good reason other than the fact that he's a once in a generationally talented politician. And that's.
He's like working overtime to preserve his record of people thinking he did something.
Yeah, his legacy is fucking the ACA and Medicare for All destroys that, right?
He is, you know, and he, like you said, he's a really good politician.
Yeah,
he's really good at it. Brilliant. And I think that should be acknowledged. Hats off, because I used to say, being, you know, a member of the Democratic Party, I just wanted a winner, right? I really wanted a winner.
Yeah. He's definitely a winner. So is Bill Clinton.
He's a winner. Yeah, yeah,
and
Bill Clinton.
And so might Joe Biden be, you know, like these winners are fucking bad.
I don't know if Joe Biden.
I'm just saying, like that's the whole argument that he's making, right? The whole argument that he's making is that he can win, and like whether or not it's true. I mean, a friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours, who I love and respect, has a very fucking stupid opinion on this.
Yeah, I won't say anything because he can kill me. So
I don't know him on those terms, though. He's never.
But
beaten
me. I'm in an argument. So I was in when I was back in Florida. I was on the Democratic Executive Committee of our local party, and I was the head of the Young Democrats.
In Orleans Parish?
No. Oklahoma County.
Oh, no shit.
That's a poor one. Yeah.
You know, I just got on the DPEC in Jefferson Parish, and I'm on the Central Committee for the state.
Great. I recommend everyone, if you're in DSA or you're further to the left than DSA, go out to your local Democratic Party. And
you will learn some shit. Available. You will learn some shit, at least about how people think about these things.
Sure, you learn that, which is another thing, and it's crazy, which is what, well, I can get into that later. But like, also, if you're frustrated with what the Democratic Party is presenting to you right now, your local Democratic Party can be taken over like that.
Yeah.
Like, unless you live in a big city, unless you live in a big city and with like an old school, like this is like, you know, these people move up through it. If you're not in New York or somewhere, you can go down there because it's a lot of retirees who are overworked anyway, who would love for someone younger to take on.
You can take it over. They will thank you for it. They'll fucking canvass for you. Like that, like it's one of these situations where they literally don't have people there that are doing the work that need that they want to be done. And like these are like extreme, like, and they run the sort of like ideological gamut, right? They can be because the Democratic Party is like kind of a mess. Like the big tent idea is kind of a mess. It's good and like. It's good in the fact that it brings in people, but it doesn't do anything from there, right? But like you can essentially start talking to people, and they're all like the people that I work with. I'm in Jefferson Parish, right? I got a bunch of do-gooders who are just like always just like sad about the state of the country, and like you know what? I can work with that because these people say they recognize at a base level that something is wrong, and they kind of don't, but maybe they do, but they kind of. don't they don't work with the options, or maybe they don't see the option. I don't want to like talk down about or of
no,
these
but they're
people.
Used to being on the outside. Yeah. They're used to being the losing party, and yeah. they're kind of conditioned to being the losing party, and they're trying to find camaraderie in like being on the outside.
Yeah.
And then when I went in, I was kind of like, I don't want to lose. I want to win. You know,
and these folks will fight too. They will fight. They'll fight.
They will, if
and
they're
they
organized.
Can take a punch yeah. because they are used to it. They're used to taking a punch, and then they're used to disappointment, and that's important too. Damn it!
Well, that was, you know, why my argument has always been that like we're kind of getting things a little wrong, and I don't want to like shit on anybody, but
no, of
a lot
not.
Of our current kind of rebirth of leftism in America is coming from like New York is coming from. Places like where people have a big yeah. platform
where you right? cannot get into Democratic executive committees as easily.
You can't. And I think that leftism in America really needs to look to the South, because all of us have been like, you know, fighting. And it's people who have been like just fighting in their personal lives, in their professional lives, in their political lives from the get-go, right? And can show you how to just get out there and fight for it. But if you like what the advice I'm giving to people, like I was back in Florida to move back from Japan. I'm there for like maybe a month. I'm on the Democratic Executive Committee, not because I'm any kind of political genius, just because I showed up and I'm head of the Young Democrats because they wanted someone to volunteer to do it. And I said, OK,
you know how I got on the Executive Committee? I registered for an election with the Secretary of State. In Jefferson Parish and the Central Committee, I registered for election. Nobody ran against me. I paid $120 that somebody fronted for me because he's a nice guy and I didn't have it. And then next thing I know, I win two elections with zero votes. It was that fucking hard.
The Jeff Pack wins again.
Yeah, zero votes.
Right. And then what I want people to understand is you can have really real influence from that position, because the steps between your local Democratic Executive Committee and being like a state committee person, right, and going to all of these things where you're delegates, all of these things where you have real world influence, all these things where you can change what the state party does, it's right there for you. Like my big push when I was in them was to have the Young Democrats be able to have meetings to bring in people who are no party affiliation. Right. That was my big fight. And I tried to explain over and over again that, like, there's a lot of people who are no party affiliation for really good reasons. Right.
Right.
But they believe in stuff that we believe in.
Yeah.
They want health care for people. They are not homophobic. They don't like racism. Mm-hmm. But they don't see the Democratic Party as being like an avenue.
No, they don't give them anything. They don't. There's no upside to it. In fact, it's just an anchor. Scott,
people don't see like how ripe like the areas outside of New Orleans really are. The place I live is turning purple. Like our parish president is not even affiliated with a political party. Like,
That's classic Chalmette in the no political party affiliation sense. But I do think that Guy McGinnis, who's the president in St. Bernard Parish, isn't a bad guy. He's a do-gooder type, and I know because he coached me in high school. He was the get back guy for the football team. He was the get back guy. You know what that is?
No.
The get back guy when you're on the football team is the guy that's No. He's like, oh, there's the sideline. You need to get back.
Oh, you pull him back so they don't get a penalty for being on the field.
Yeah, that's what he – and he coached softball. He coached basketball. Both of his daughters went to school with me. Like, I know Guy a little bit, and I haven't talked to him in years, but, like, he's a good guy. You know
I was at a job fair just, like, you know, trying to get a job, and he just, like, walked in, no entourage.
I mean, he's the fucking.
He was just like, I'm making a phone call. I was like, "Don't say hi to the guy." I'm like, "Nah."
Yeah. Anyway,
that's my political advice. If you're frustrated with where Democratic politics is right now, it takes a long time, but show up and do the stuff locally, and things change, man.
Super last thing on this, and then I think we probably should end it. But like, and I'll give you the last word for sure. But the thing about the Democratic Party, even if you like don't think it's the solution, and I'm kind of agnostic on that, right?
Right.
It is a part of the political apparatus that exists in this country. And you would be essentially, you're not being a great materialist if you don't at least acknowledge and engage it. And my sort of vision of like what a politics has to be, and this always fucking feels like a cop out, but there has to be kind of like a both inside outside sort of game, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have a structure and a force that's organized that can sort of like push from inside the Democratic Party. And this, I mean, from inside the Democratic Party and from outside, almost like in lockstep. That's the sort of like only way I see anything either like replacing or just reinventing the Democratic Party, and I don't care which.
Yeah, so I'm a huge critic of the Democratic Party, right? I'm frustrated with them, angry at them all the time. But I would just say to people, like, if you, in reality, there is a political party that represents like around half of America, and it has a gigantic institutional structure that has the ability to pull the levels of power.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason you wouldn't want to take that over?
Yeah.
Is there a reason that you wouldn't want to have access to that? Like, and I'm not saying like compromise everything you believe or anything that you believe. I'm just saying that apparatus is there, and that you can, without compromising anything you believe, unless your main central belief is to not be involved in Democratic politics, okay?
Right.
But if you would like to have access to that power, it's there to be taken over if you want to do it.
And I love that, because that is a fundamentally materialist argument, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're making, maybe it's a bit abstract, but like the Democratic Party is an apparatus. It is a material structure that can be leveraged and utilized to create and get political results. Similarly with unions, even if you're a fucking like, and this is not a place that idea that I've subscribed to, is like you know, unions or whatever are like, especially like bureaucratic unions are like traitors to the working class or whatever, which I saw a lot of that kind of talk coming out after like the culinary union made their dumbass decision to like back Biden, or like soft back Biden. Yeah, well, it's leadership. And also, like, even if you don't like agree with leadership and you think leadership's a bunch of fucking assholes, labor unions fundamentally are organizations that at some point in this process have to represent workers, you know? And you cannot just write off these kinds of organizations like that, you know? Right. And maybe I'm doing a straw man here, and I feel maybe I am, but like, we really do need to make sure that when we're making those kinds of arguments, that like, if you think the fucking culinary union, or if you think NEA, who just backed Biden or whatever, if you think that they're fucking, you know, full of shit or wrong or whatever, you cannot just say then like summarily that NEA is bad, you know, or you can't even.
It's a complex organization, right?
Yeah, and
it's not bad or good, really.
And like, you have to, in a certain sense, make it clear that the critique you're making is. You have to make sure that the critique you're making is qualified in some way. And almost like you need, like, I almost don't want to even go into that kind of argument or make that kind of a claim publicly. You know what I mean? Yeah, I get very nervous about it just because I'm very fucking precious. And I've had my own internal struggles in my union for that kind of thing.
Right.
Anyway, anything else, Wes, Scott?
Last thing I'll say, everyone, please take the coronavirus thing very, very seriously.
Yeah.
And I will tell you I think that the society in America that existed 2 weeks ago and the society in America that's going to exist a year from now are two very, very different things.
Yeah.
And
we there's going to be definitely going to be like a post corona and like pre-corona era. Like.
Yeah, through the looking glass, folks.
Yeah, we're looking at the transition of eras right now.
Yeah.
And that is political too. So it's time to start get your head around that and start thinking about what kind of world we want to have.
Cool, man.
Remember how immobile like everything seemed like as far as like the government budget and stuff? Like a week ago.
Yep.
But the debt. Yeah, well, anyway, the coronavirus is bad for the dang debt. Anyway.
It's really bad for the debt, which anyway, completely exists somewhere.
I am so glad that we had you on. We're definitely going to have you back sometime, man.
All right, anytime, man. Cool. I'm around the office.
Yeah. Tell your family, you know, your beautiful kids that hello and that you love them and all that kind of stuff, man. It's really great see you.
Actually, do have a final word.
You got one?
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands for sure.
Wipes here.
And happy birthday twice.
Yeah. My alcohol spray.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. You can listen to Good Morning Comrade every Tuesday on whivfm.org/listen. You can check us out online, 102.3 in New Orleans. Check us out on Twitter at Comrade Morning. You want to shout out your Twitter on your podcast, Wes?
I'm Wes in Japan. I usually just shit post, but I'm posting more actual disaster stuff now.
No, Wes is a very good follow.
Thank you. And I'm also... Atticus Shrugged podcast. We're on everywhere where you can get your podcast. We talk about Southern culture and politics.
Yeah.
We haven't recorded an episode in a few weeks because one of our members has the flu, but it's just the flu. So check us out.
All right, buddy. Really, really cool seeing you. It's really good seeing your face and hearing your voice, man. It really is. All right, man.
All right, nice. Talk again.
Take care, brother. Bye.